God has revealed many things, but some people know very little of what they're supposed to believe. Secondly, part of the scope of what to believe is to understand what we believe, so that what covers two things. It covers the truths that God has revealed. It also includes the meaning of what God has revealed. And I believe the single greatest need of the church today is to teach people not only what they are to believe, but also what they believe, to try to understand it. Of course, it means that a person must himself have been duly instructed, and it's especially in understanding the faith. This understanding can come only from study, prayer, and practice. And that is why those who are to teach others must themselves, as deeply as possible, understand their faith. Secondly, we are to teach others why they believe. Now, I'll go over each of these in detail, but I want to lay the groundwork first. I think many people who may have heard a great deal about what God has revealed, but they don't really understand why they should believe. And then thirdly, people need to be told on how both to preserve and grow in the faith. There are therefore three purposes that are covered by that one question, how to teach the faith. We are to teach others what they are to believe and what the faith means. We are to teach others why they believe. And we are to teach others how they can keep their faith in today's unbelieving world. In fact, how they are to grow in their faith. As far as the method goes, first of all, in teaching others what to believe, there are traditionally four large areas of the content of the faith. They are the Apostles' Creed, the Ten Commandments, the Eight Beatitudes, and the Seven Sacraments. And I would say that among religious, no religious should be admitted even to first vows unless they know, and I don't mean just know by heart to recite, but can explain, at least briefly, what the 12 articles of the Creed mean, the Ten Commandments, the Beatitudes, and the Sacraments. And the depth of ignorance is beyond description. And this among religious. Widespread ignorance. Now this means, speaking again about religious, they must provide, if they want to survive, to teach the young people from the beginning. Somebody must teach them. And of course, those who teach in the community must have their teaching supported by others from outside the community. It is impossible to exaggerate, how important this is. The only communities that are going to survive, no matter how big, how flourishing they are those in which superiors are clear and firm on teaching the faith. This means you cannot have anybody hearing confessions. You cannot have anybody saying Mass. You can't have just anybody giving conferences or homilies. And I would say you have to be especially careful what books and magazines are read. Last Thursday in New York, I was with the Missionaries of Charity in the morning, and one of the sisters, very educated person, she showed me a copy of Barclay's. Heard about Barclay's commentary on the New Testament. Nicely bound. And sadly recommended by Archbishop Shane. So I asked, where'd you get that? Well, somebody gave it to the community. So I looked up the superior and I said, get these books out of the convent. So I'll be there next Wednesday. And I'll ask you, they got rid of the books. He denies the real presence. He denies the papal primacy. He denies Mary's virginity. Stupid. And you can say that there are many pages that are very pious. Maybe they are. They're not true. There's so much confusion. So on the what to believe, I say there are four areas. But it's not only teaching others what to believe, but also they have to be trained what not to believe. Then why we believe. This is not as obvious as may seem, because in today's world, people are questioning everything. And consequently, either people are convinced that what they believe has a solid foundation, so they don't believe just because they want to believe, because everybody else does. Not too many years ago, that's why many people believe, because everybody around them had the faith. But now when so few people, depending on where you are, so few people really share the pure Orthodox Catholic faith, every place they turn, they're being asked, why? Why do you still believe this? Do you still believe that? They can't just say, I'm going to believe. But I have to know why. This is called the credibility of faith. And many of these things you simply cannot presume that people have, no matter how simple and apparently strong their faith may seem to be. There are, first of all, the preambles of faith. First, God's existence. We cannot reasonably believe in what God tells us unless somehow, to some degree, our reason is convinced that God exists. Otherwise, I'll believe because I believe, because I believe. And the first doubt about God's existence that comes into the mind, the faith is swept away. Consequently, it is not going through long courses in philosophy. But, for example, the five ways for proving God's existence in St. Thomas, so-called quinquevie, simplify, but should be taught. We must first know that God exists. Then, God's attributes. I must know something about this God from reason, if I am to reasonably accept His word. Now, the two things that the mind, this is the foundation, the rational foundations for the faith, that the mind should know about God or His attributes are first His infinite wisdom. The God is all wise. Otherwise, why should I reasonably accept His word unless I first know, to some extent, that He knows what He's talking about? And secondly, God's infinite goodness. If somebody tells me something which I have not myself experienced, if I'm to believe that person, I must first know that person knows what he's talking about, right? And I must secondly know that he's a good person, an honest person, who's telling me the truth. And if a person never gives any thought to this, and I think a lot of people believe because their parents believed, or people around them believed, but as that is swept aside, we're standing on our own two feet. So the preambles. Secondly, we must know the fact of revelation. In other words, that it's a fact that this God about whom we know that He exists, He knows what He's talking about, and He's honest and truthful when He speaks. I must have some evidence that God spoke. I've been teaching other religious systems for over 20 years, Hinduism, Buddhism, Islam. They all claim they have a revelation. So why should I, as a Christian, believe in Christ? This is what I think a lot of people, Catholics, are not eager to make converts. And why there's so much pluralism, as they call it, in the church today, people claiming that you can be a Muslim, you can be a Hindu or a Buddhist or a Christian, and provided you follow your conscience, you follow your lights, don't disturb the Hindu, let him be a good Hindu. Don't disturb the Muslim, let him be a good Muslim. that Christianity has nothing to teach these people. Well, that's not true. Because if we have grounds, for rational grounds, on which we can base our faith that God Himself became a human being to give us the revelation, and I can prove that to my mental satisfaction, then if we're talking about why we believe, then my faith will not be neutralized because somebody else has an opposite faith. Okay. Now there are two principal things that need to be established. And all I can tell you is, and I deal with a lot of religious and a lot of priests, including by many, many who have lost their faith. And if this looks like, well, I'm going back to school and learning, well, so be it. Unless believers are kept in protective custody behind walls and out of contact with the unbelieving world, they better be able to satisfy their minds. The first is the history. Of God's revelation. And for us especially to establish what is called the historicity of Christ and His teaching and His actions. There really was a Christ. He was really born in Bethlehem. He really lived in Nazareth. Preached in Jerusalem. He really suffered. He really died. And He really rose from the dead. Because other believers, they will go to Mohammed. They will go to Buddha. So now, for example, in one diocese after another, Catholics are joining the Moonies. The Hare Krishna, all kinds of weird cults. And either Catholics know that their faith is founded on history, fact, or, well, one myth is as good as another. If Christianity is just founded on mythology, and it's much harder to practice than other religions, people are going to give up. And secondly, miracles. It is impossible to exaggerate the importance of the role of miracles in making our faith credible. First of all, the miracles of the Gospels. That they were really worked by Christ. And especially, and just a week away, that Christ, who died on the cross, actually rose from the dead. Until the council, I don't know of a single seminary in the United States that did not have this as a course, prescribed course, for those to be ordained priests. I taught this in the seminary myself to Jesuit priests, or men who were to be ordained, for 9 years. And today, I know of only 2 seminaries that teach this. No wonder the priests are leaving in droves. And while they're preaching strange doctrine, because their faith does not have a credible, rational foundation. And I would say the same thing for religious. And I would further say this, that the more educated the members of a community are because of their apostolate, the more they have to have a rational, educated foundation for why they believe. That's why the most stable communities in our country today are those communities that are not in education. The Little Sisters of the Poor. This community here that are not basically in education. Mother Teresa's Missionaries of Charity. Now, she's a very intelligent woman. We've talked about this more than once. She just has nothing but compassion for communities that are in education, because most of the destruction of women's communities has been among those in education. And the same with the men, our Jesuits. Because the same mind that will be educated to the hilt in secular subjects, whatever they are, either that mind is satisfied that what I believe is true and knows why it is true, can defend itself to itself, or even if a person decides they should stay in the religious life or the priesthood, but it'll be only for other reasons than because they're really convinced it's true. This is a large subject, and when I teach it in theology, a 2-semester course, 3 classes a week for 30 weeks. We're talking about why we believe. And the only fear I have, even as I say this, is that either those who listen, or listen now, or afterwards may listen to the tapes, or read what is written, to say to themselves, well, I can see there is something there, but frankly, I don't think it touches our community. It sure does. If a Thomas Merton could have lost so much of his faith, and he lost much of it before he died. I knew him personally. He was swept off his feet by studying Oriental religions until his Catholic faith became so mushy that his first biographer said, he died a Buddhist. I don't think he did. I think he still had some basic Christian faith left. But he read too much in these strange religions without having founded himself strong enough in why he believed as a Catholic. Our third area of how to teach the faith, and we're talking about the what and the why and now the how. I will spend a good deal of time on this because the people that come to us already have the faith. So it's a question of how to preserve and grow in the faith. I recommend 5 means for preserving and growing in the faith. First, practice the faith. This is one examination of conscience that I'm afraid many Catholics have never bothered making. But we should periodically ask ourselves, and those entering a community should be told from the very beginning. Make a checklist of the mysteries of faith which they believe. And then ask themselves, how am I living up to what I supposedly believe? I believe in God. Do I put my faith in God into practice? If I believe there is a God, how often do I think of Him? How often do I talk to Him? If I believe that this God, by His providence, governs everything in the world, the least thing in my life is somehow an act of God. Everything. Do I act that way? Do I spontaneously associate every occurrence, especially the painful, with God's will? Again, if I believe in God and believe in His providence, I believe, so I say, that nothing ever enters my life by chance. Everything in my life is an opportunity which God gives me to show my love for Him. Well, people can go through an 18-hour day and all kinds of graces are sticking out all over the place. It never occurs to them. And those are opportunities put into their lives by God. The saints became saints because they saw God's hand in everything. And they acted accordingly. So first, practice the faith. Secondly, meditate on the faith. And this is where I fault many books of meditation, otherwise good. But most of them so concentrate on the moral side of the spiritual life, and they ignore the foundation of the spiritual life, which is faith. There are 10 commandments. The first 3 have to do with religion. The last 7 have to do with morality, morals. I think I've been doing this certainly since I came back from my studies after ordination. I suppose by now I must have given 100 conferences or homilies on this subject. And this will be at least the homilets. The principal purpose of meditation is not to practice virtue. God knows we need to practice the moral virtues. The principal purpose of meditation is to understand the faith, to penetrate the faith, to grasp the meaning of my faith. That I meditate on who God is, on who Christ is. That I live in His presence, that I talk to Him. That I'm not forever asking to be more patient, more humble, more loving, more kind. A person who realizes who God is and who enjoys living in Christ's presence, he doesn't have to listen to one conference after another on being more patient. You live in God's presence and you're going to be patient. So meditating on the faith in other words, adoration, worship, praise, honor, paying attention to God, just talking to God, so that my prayer is not, though I do not exclude, asking for help, I need it, but that my prayer includes a large amount of just thinking of God, talking to God, enjoying being with God, with Christ, with Our Lady, with the angels, with the saints. Thirdly, pray. Pray to keep and grow in the faith. And I would say especially when your faith is tested. And nowadays, if your life is like mine, our faith is tested every day. We read things, we see things, we experience things that test our faith. I'm in chapel making my meditation. A priest walks into chapel, never bothers genuflecting before the Blessed Sacrament. Well, I gotta do something. So I tell the Lord, Lord, I believe You're here. Strengthen my faith. Fourth, study the faith. Now we've been talking about this all along the line, but just to zero in on this very important obligation. The new code of canon law says religious must study their faith all their lives. And of course, as we said before, let me repeat. Be sure that the books you have, that those who are under your care have access to, are good books. For example, in my Sunday class last time I was here, and Dr. Kelly, one of the students, brought me a little paperback by Bernard Herring. on the sacrament of confession. In the middle of the book it says that it's very hard to commit a mortal sin if a few minutes after you've done something wrong, if you are sorry soon after you've done it, then you may be sure you did not commit a mortal sin. You just shot a person and they're bleeding to death in front of you. And you say to yourself, gosh, I shouldn't have done that. Then you don't have to confess it. That's the so-called theory of the fundamental option. Well, you must make sure that the books you read, it happens to have an imprimatur. A lot of good that is nowadays. So, study the faith through reading, through listening, conferences, and it's becoming increasingly difficult. I know what I'm saying. To get priests that you can fully rely on. Retreat masters. In St. Louis, this is some years ago, Superior called me up right after, late at night, about 10 o'clock, and she said, we just started a retreat tonight. I hate to get you up this, or I was already retired. But the retreat master said some strange things that bothered me and bothered some of the other sisters. What should I do? So I said, well, talk to your provincial council at the provincial house and see if the other sisters would agree with you. And she described what the priest had said. It was way off base. Then if you get the vote of the council and meet them before Mass, call an emergency meeting of the council. Then after Mass, you tell Father that the council and I have decided that you should no longer continue with the retreat. And here is your check, your stipend for the retreat. So about 10 o'clock the next morning, she called me up. She was very difficult, but I did it. She gave him the money. But of course, he just called her all kinds of names for being so pre-Vatican and out of touch with the world. But one retreat is enough to ruin a community, in case you don't know. Classes. One reason that we're starting home study, which will be also convent study and rectory study, classes in the faith under the aegis of the Holy See, is because you just cannot get enough competent, thoroughly Orthodox teachers. So study the faith. The faith should be discussed. And this covers everything we believe. Finally, share the faith. If we want to keep our faith and grow in it, we must decide to share it. In other words, we are to be missionaries or apostolic, because the first duty of a missionary or of an apostle is to proclaim the faith. Everything else follows. How do we proclaim the faith? We proclaim the faith by putting it into action so that people can see, as Christ tells us, that they may see your good works and glorify your Father who is in heaven. The good example. Some people have never realized that they have a duty, a real obligation, to give a good example. How do we share the faith? By talking about what we believe. It's remarkable, and often after the first months or years in the community, are we religious? Can fall into some very secular conversation. And not just with outsiders, but in the community. And of course, this means conversation about the things of God with other people. There's a real art to spiritual conversation. People expect us to talk about what we believe. How do we share our faith? By correspondence. I think we can all look into our correspondence and find out whether we are writing as much as we can, as often as we can, and better write to more people and tell each one less than write to one person or a few people and write long letters. But it's in our letters that they can tell from every sentence who we are, what we believe, what we stand for. How do we share the faith? And this is the hardest. By suffering for the faith. Because if we may not be in a position to do a lot of teaching or preaching, by our patient suffering and enduring of the cross, we obtain grace for those who have that position, especially bishops and priests.